Hello, and welcome to this episode of Team GP Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything regarding general practice, brought to you by the RCGP Membership Communities and Engagement Team. I am Dr. James Thambiraja, a practicing GP based in Southwest London and North Hampshire Urgent Care. I'm the former First Five Lead and former Vice Chair of RCGP Southwest Thames Faculty. For South Asian Heritage Month 2024, I will be hosting a podcast series discussing what South Asian heritage means to GPs. In this episode, I will be speaking to Dr. Nigat Arif and what it means to be a female South Asian GP. Before we begin, I think it's important to point out that doctors from a South Asian heritage make up around over 20% of RCGP members and are an extremely important part of the healthcare system within the UK. In light of South Asian Heritage Month, we would like to celebrate and highlight their lived experiences, hearing how their heritage has shaped the way in which they interact with patients and what led them into general practice. If you're listening to this with even a small interest that you'd like to explore through the college, I hope our guest stories will encourage you to reach out and get involved.
I'd like to welcome Dr. Nigat Arif. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. A real privilege to have Nigat here with us. So Nigat, tell us a bit about yourself for those who don't know you already.
Well, you joined me in my surgery, so that's always a bit of a nice way to introduce myself as a GP, but I have a specialist interest in women's health. I live in Buckinghamshire, and I always say the most important thing I ever do is that I'm the mother to three boys, as well as being a mum, a wife, and a GP. I'm a medical broadcaster with BBC Breakfast and also ITV's This Morning. I'm an author to my book, which is called The Knowledge, Your Guide to Female Health from Menstruation to the Menopause. And it's best-selling and hopefully going to be translated into 40 languages across the globe. It's done really, really well. Mm-hmm. And I work with the World Health Organization FIDES program, as well as YouTube Health as a health content creator on socials, mainly around making educational accessible content in different languages. In Punjabi, I'm South Asian, I'm from Pakistan, I speak Punjabi. And then finally, I think the other thing that I do a lot is that I really do a lot of advocacy work for women's health. So I'm the ambassador for well-being of women. I sit on select committee hearings at the government trying to look at menopause care, menstrual health coalition. I sit on that as well. About a month ago, I got the honorary fellowship from the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology in recognition of my work, which was really, really incredible, from fellow colleagues, as well as the 2023 Prime Minister's Point of Light Award for my work around looking at women's health for marginalised communities.
Huge congratulations, first of all. Full disclosure, Dr. Nigat Arif is one of my GP heroes. I'm so thrilled to have her on this podcast. So it's a real privilege. It's a real honour, personal privilege. Let's just jump straight in. Yeah. So South Asian heritage, what does that mean to you? You kind of touched on it, but what does it mean to you personally?
It means a sense of identity to me, and that level of identity of where are you as a South Asian person. For me, I'm an immigrant first. I think that I can't take that away from my story. I came here at the age of 9 off at Heathrow Airport in a small summery t-shirt and a skirt with flip-flops, because my father had promised my mother, don't worry, we're going to England. It's very sunny out there and it's green. My mother thought we were going to Barbados or the Caribbean. That wasn't the case. We arrived at Heathrow in the torrential April showers. And that was really, I felt like an alien, because for a long time, am I Pakistani or am I British? And that was always the question that was thrown at me. And later on, you sort of get this identity factor. Well, where do you belong? Well, you don't really belong here because you weren't born here. So that was the other thing. Well, you don't belong here because you don't have the skin color. And then finally, as I grew up, I'm a Muslim woman. I wear the hijab. And again, I'm very sort of, that's very different from the norm. So I stand out because of the fact that I wear a hijab. And again, that question of identity. And South Asian communities, I feel that we're still a diaspora of different communities brought together, Sri Lankan, Bangladeshi, Nepalese, Indian, We're scattered across the world, but I do feel that having South Asian heritage might allows you to have that commonality, that identity factor, the factor that you have so many things that you can celebrate together and feel a sense of belonging, because I'm constantly trying to find that. Where do I belong wherever I am? And that's why South Asian Heritage Month means a lot to me.
Thank you so much. So I suppose that kind of follows on to what my next question, which kind of is linked. So how does this heritage, how does it affect, let's start with the first question. How does it affect your relationship with your colleagues and your practice as a doctor and your media work as well? Or does it, does it affect you? Or do you think about it at all consciously?
I do, because it's really weird, because I think in Punjabi, at home we speak Punjabi. My mother tongue. And so all my conversations with my mother, the women at the mosque, I'm the imam's daughter, and that's a place of safety for a lot of women in my community. And someone who does women's health, the intersectionality of how that interplays is huge, because these women, sometimes they don't have the lexicon to be able to explain their symptoms. So, for example, I'll give you menopause. A lot of women don't complain of hot flushes. And so I'd go to the mosque and be like, do you get hot flushes? Which is the Western trained NHS GP that I am. And they'd look at me and say, stand in the 50 degree heat in Pakistan, you'll know what a hot flush is. And then I realized, actually, but they'll complain of head to toe pain. So that sort of Punjabi way of explaining things was the visceral way of how I understood how women need to explain what they're going through, because actually we don't have the words for, say, breasts or ovaries or vulva or vagina. They're derogatory or swear words. How do you give ownership as a medical professional? So I do think of how can I translate this to my community, which is where a lot of my content plays a role, because that's how I started in the pandemic. And then in my work, I'm really lucky. I'm part of an incredibly mixture of colleagues. I'm Pakistani. I work with a Bangladeshi colleague. His specialist interest is diabetes. He's brilliant. I have a colleague who she's from Sri Lanka. But they're all second generation born. So I feel like I'm not second generation. I feel like I'm a first generation in this country. And so when I started going on to TV, and that really started at the height of the pandemic in 2020, we were all in lockdown. Yeah. BBC Breakfast phoned me up and said, we're looking for a group of doctors. Do you want to be one of our GPs and tell us what's happening? Because all the GP doors are closed. And I was like, no. The doors are closed, but we are definitely working behind those doors from a remote consulting. And I've always looked like this, the way I wear my hijab, the way I look, the way I speak. To me, that wasn't different. But then being on TV in my kitchen with a cup of tea at 6:30 in the morning as a regular doctor on a Monday before I headed off to clinic, it was like Middle England had woken up to go, oh, actually, South Asian women, brown women who wear hijabs, they're not suppressed, depressed or repressed. Yeah. So that sort of inclination of what we are like, I think, was a real sort of eye opener, which came with a lot of amazing. I feel myself seen and represented to the point where it was almost the vitriol of racism, Islamophobia, sexism, misogyny. All of that sort of came to a front at a time when there was high levels of anxiety, unpredictability in the whole world, actually, not just in the UK, when we're having repeated lockdowns. So it was really like, who do we trust? Do we trust this woman that's on TV? And to me, I thought that, well, I'm just from home. I'm between this camera, the Zoom camera, and then on screen on TV, and it's really remote. And it was only when I came out of lockdown, I realized the impact that was having, because women would come up and go, I finally feel seen and heard. I finally feel that there is somebody who looks like me. Or because I'm so proud that you are quite confident and you are very secure in your identity, the hijab gives me that sense of identity. That they have felt comfortable enough to sort of either wear the hijab themselves or think about it. And I think all those conversations we've still got to have as a South Asian community, we're not having enough of those. And I don't know what the right or wrong answer is, but I do think that we need, as South Asian people, as clinicians, to have that open, frank conversation about the difficulties that we face because of the color of our skin. That still isn't a national conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. I must say, that was one of my fondest memories, seeing your BBC Breakfast. I did have kitchen envy, if I'm honest, and your art and your artwork behind you. And I said to my wife, we need to get artwork. Like, against, like, kitchen is very nice.
It's really funny you say that, because yeah, when we did the Zoom call originally with the producers, I'll tell you a really small story. I went round with my phone and my iPad, and I was like, this is what I've got. And the producers kept saying to me, do you have a bookshelf? Because everybody, if you remember, James, had a bookshelf. Matt Hancock would be sat there.
Yes.
And I was like, I really don't have a bookshelf. We had just renovated our house, and literally in February 2020 had moved back into our house after renovating it. So don't have kitchen envy. It doesn't look like that now.
No, I'm sure it does. There was an account called Room Rater, I think, on Twitter or X now. And I'm sure your kitchen will be ready to turn out of 10.
I appeared on that, which really amazed me, because I just thought, I think it humanised a lot of healthcare professionals, because suddenly you could see them at home in their own settings. And it, you know, my kids would walk in constantly at most live interviews that I was doing, but that's real life.
Well, I think, you know, you've touched on that. You know, I think seeing you during the pandemic, seeing you online on TV, I think we've had conversations offline about how representation matters. I think you once posted something online that really struck a chord with me, and I can't remember, forgive me. It was about heritage and kids, and, you know, what our kids are going through and the obstacles. But before I get to that, about kind of the obstacles, you mentioned your colleagues. What about patients? Both, does your South Asian heritage come up when you're looking after patients, both from your community or outside your community? And following on from that to my next question, what kind of, you touched on it briefly, but perhaps you could elaborate on the obstacles or the challenges you face in regards to working in your ecosystem as someone with your heritage.
Yeah, I trained at Barts in London, so I was immersed in a Bangladeshi, South Asian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan, Indian population. And so to me, it was just this wealth of knowledge and these incredible, it was my superpower to be able to speak Punjabi with my patients. And I still consider it that the fact that I'm bilingual is my superpower. I then went on to work at Wexham Park Hospital, again, a very much in Slough, a South Asian population, and I did general practice in Wexham Park for many, many years. And again, that was my near Southall as well. So that was, again, my superpower. And that I felt gave me the edge on my colleagues. Not that I'm looking for an edge, but it meant that there was this instant connection that I would have with men and women, children who'd come in, who'd see a fellow Punjabi speaking. And I think that we need to get more confident in speaking our different languages and not shy away from it. I never would find the right words or the right context. So those are all the good, lovely stories. And I think that made me a better clinician, because I, instead of learning from books, was learning from my patients firsthand. Yeah. And, you know, when you're seeing 35 patients a day on a really busy day in Slough, honestly, that there's no other teaching ground. And I still hold that really dear now. On the other side, when I went to other places, which was more Caucasian, the population, because as you know, when we train as GPs, we have to move practices around a lot. I found that when there was a global event, the patients would find that really difficult. So they would either come and talk to me about it, and in my consultation mention that, especially I'm thinking about sort of Islamophobia stuff. So the terrorist connection, the fact that I'm a Muslim, you know, am I a terrorist? I had one particular occasion when I took over a list from a very well-established GP for many, many years. She was there for 15 years and then she retired. So really well-loved. She was white, Caucasian, and went into her shoes to fill her practice, which was a huge undertaking. And for the first, sort of, I would say, at least 3 months, patients would phone just because they saw my name and how ethnic it sounds, to make sure that I could speak English and the accent that I spoke with. And I think accents play a huge aspect into regards to how much trust that patients have with you. The fact that I speak the way I do, I'm a Buckinghamshire person. When I came to the UK, I spoke no English. I learned English. And this is the accent, unfortunately, that I inherited. From Buckinghamshire. And so that made it very different, because they would look at me and have this assumption. And then I'd open my mouth and be like, Oh, and I've genuinely had patients sit in my room, say to me, "Oh, you talk like us." And I had another stark occasion where a patient sort of came in, very well to do, quite a posh lady who had a white GP for a very long time, who looked at me up and down and just said, "That's not my GP. My GP isn't brown." And I think that there are certain contexts in environments that we have that some people feel that they have a right to say that without being challenged. Luckily, my colleagues all rallied around and said, "Actually, that's a very racist comment to make." And I have been getting a lot of support from my colleagues. You will always get those individuals who will have an issue with how you look, the color of your skin, the way you dress. And the only thing I can say is that I'm quite confident in my skin. I've got to the age of 40 very confident because I've always looked like this. Like I can't change the pigment or my melanin. I can't do that. And it's a learning curve of how you manage those difficult situations and to a point where you ignore that. When it comes to media, my immediate circle is very kind, and I've just become very, very good at finding the block button. So if you don't like me or you don't like what I'm saying, I'm going to block it. And that's not really, sometimes I thought it's more protection for me, but I've realized it's for the protection of people who follow me. So about 6 months ago, if you're getting, I get a lot of women who are Muslim in my social media comments who will say, "Sister, please don't talk about vaginas, this is haram. Haram is sinful in our language in Punjabi."
Why do you think, sorry
And
to check again, why do you think that is though? Why is that?
I think, again, as a community, as Muslim women, as South Asian women, we haven't got over the patriarchy and the misogyny and the internalized misogyny. And so when you see someone doing that, the first instinct is, this is sinful or this is shameful, but they can eat it, kind of put it under the carpet. Swipe it, don't air your dirty laundry. We still inherently, I grew up with the phrase, "Log kya kahenge?" What will people say? I grew up with that. I'm the daughter of the imam. Like, you can't get more conversations about what will people think of you or what will people say about you. And that cuts deep. And so when I'm on socials, there are some individuals who feel that's still okay to say. And I actually delete them and block them and broke, because I'm like, don't bring your toxicity into my comments, because I've got a lot of South Asian women, South Asian men, who also look at that, and actually impacts on their mental health to think what I'm watching is inappropriate when all they're doing is trying to learn about women's health or learn about their heavy periods or their endometriosis or how to manage menopause, how to go empowered to their GP, because I'm very respectful of my GP colleagues, that we have a really hard task. And I'm fortunate enough that a lot of my GP colleagues do follow and watch my content for inspiration or just to understand a bit more, especially when it comes to the inter nuances and the intersection with marginalized communities. So I always have that sort of voice that I give that in my clinics, I'm seeing South Asian patients. So let me share that, because you might not have that in your area, but actually you have pockets of it and you want to do better. And I think that I've become more protective of my followers now. Where before I was protective for myself, but now I'm more protective for my my followers who go into the comments to read the comments.
It must be quite hard for you though as well, because all you're doing is you're doing so much. You're kind of educating people, you're inspiring people, but then people are just misinterpreting and kind of just twisting it into their own, well, twisting it with regards to their own interpretation. That must be really frustrating for you.
Because medicine isn't medicine, right? Medicine is intersectioned with your faith, your upbringing, your culture, and your own lived-in trauma. And I completely appreciate people's lived-in experiences, because actually we learn from that as clinicians. And so if you're putting something on socials and you look like me, people will feel that it's appropriate to make either a derogatory comment, a sexist comment, a misogynist comment. So I will get men, in fact, and women from my community who are sometimes the harshest towards me. And I think that's because we internally, and this is why South Asian Heritage Month is so important, because we need to have these difficult lived-in traumas that we need to discuss as a community. I still think that the colonialism and that trauma that we've gone through from the partition hasn't been fully dissected and discussed, because it still rears its ugly head, because I see it. I get it on my socials, because that sort of shut up and be quiet comes from that. You toe the line. लोग क्या कहेंगे, व्हाट विल पीपल से, दैट कम्स फ्रॉम दैट सॉर्ट ऑफ एस्पेक्ट ऑफ बीइंग कंट्रोल्ड, एंड वी स्टिल हैव दैट दैट वी नीड टू डिस्कस.
Thank you for sharing that, because it must be quite hard to kind of live through that every day. What can we do as colleagues and friends of yours, or, you know, what would you say to your colleagues and friends who can support you and support, or support people who are like you? Or, you know, you mentioned that kind of your experience with the patient. I'll share one experience. There was a patient of mine when I was a junior doctor. She was Sri Lankan. I'm Sri Lankan for context. And she was telling me everything. What was going on, and then I could tell she was hiding something. I can tell she wasn't telling me something.
Yeah.
And I couldn't put my finger on it. And then she went and told a nurse. And then the nurse came up to me, James, you know, she actually has a breast lump, but she's too scared to tell you about it. She didn't want to tell you because she was embarrassed. Mm. And I remember I was so frustrated and so sad that she could tell me about everything else, but because of the stigma and the cultural stigma, and Sri Lankan culture is similar to Pakistani culture when it regards to women, that, you know, even now my mum says, James, I'm so proud of you, but I would always go see a female GP about
what. Yeah.
And that's nothing, you know, I'm not criticizing my mum, but that is her upbringing. So there's a balance between what you're comfortable with. And I think now, my mum being here for over 40 years, she's more comfortable with certain more things than she was when she left Sri Lanka. So for me, it's kind of understanding the cultural differences, but also embracing new things and embracing, new lessons, really. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the thing that brings me a bit of sadness every now and then, because when I see women, I rarely see Pakistani men. They still get, because they're like, oh, she's Pakistani. So the South Asian men don't rarely come to me. I get a lot of South Asian women. And if I do get South Asian men that come and see me, it'll always be either their wife, particularly an older generation South Asian man. That's that culture. So I'm talking about 60 and above. If they're going to come and see me, say, to manage their diabetes, it will be because they'll come with their wife. I had one gentleman who was South Asian, who's Pakistani, and I was trying to manage his high blood pressure, and he would always come in, and his sort of common ground with me would be talk about cricket. So this is going to be really sort of, you know, playing into the norm, isn't it? But he would come in and talk about his cricket all the time. I couldn't manage his blood pressure. And then I said, is everything okay at home? And he goes, actually, my wife is like this. And I thought, hang on, with my women's health hat on, I think she might be perimenopausal. So he managed to bring her in, and we managed to sort out her menopausal symptoms, but his blood pressure came down. And I think that that sort of conversation shows the dichotomy that we have as clinicians, where the patient will only reveal a part of themselves because they are still so ashamed that there is somebody from my community in front of me, where they might have maybe less inhibitions in front of a Caucasian or a different ethnicity person. And again, I think that we don't tackle that inherent racism, shall we say, or sexism within our community.
Yeah.
And colorism is a huge factor. You know, if you're and I've often seen this, if I've got a colleague who's South Asian, I'm not that dark, but to some, I'm still considered dark. Mm. And they will often say, yes, Sawali means that you're dark skinned. And I've actually had a patient once say to me, are you sure you're South Asian? Because you're really dark for South Asian. And I'm like, really? Wow. It's crazy, right? That we don't, and that's another South Asian person saying that to me. So I think that colorism discussion needs to definitely happen, as well as just the gender discussion that we're having, you know, with your mum saying, I wouldn't see a male doctor.
Yeah, it's definitely a discussion to be had. I think recently, I don't know whether you watch Netflix together, but there was a series called Indian Matchmaking. I don't know whether you saw them.
And how awful is that?
Yeah, well, I was just about to say it. I went into it thinking, you know, I'm from a Sri Lankan background, I'm similar age to you. I thought, okay, let's see what the youngsters are doing in regards to dating and things. And I thought, you know, I'm, you know, thankfully my wife and I were about to celebrate our 14th wedding anniversary, so we kind of gone through that. It's lovely. And I thought, I'm hoping the younger generation have learned something, you know, because we were struggling with so many different things. And I thought, oh my goodness, it's even worse. And there's still things that we were struggling with, things like racism, colorism, which you just mentioned, like cart, so many different things that you would struggle with. And so that, like you said, it just reminded me that even now with our youngsters, you know, younger generation, there's still things that we need to discuss and, you know, and challenge, really, because I think, you know, unless we challenge it head on, we're not going to learn from our, I don't want to say mistakes, but we don't want to learn from the mistakes of the past, and we want to try and grow. Does that make sense as well?
Yeah, and it's fascinating how much like the Western ideology of skin and respect still plays a huge part, because, you know, working for the World Health Organization, I work with a lot of health content creators. And when I speak to doctors in India, say Delhi, or they will say to me that women's health is still incredibly patriarchal. For example, the fact that in India, if a woman is accidentally pregnant and is out of wedlock, like she will be doubled, tripled the cost of, say, contraception, the bill, or not even offered an abortion, because there's that patriarchal behavior that happens. And you're just like, oh my goodness. And this is South Asian women who are having, you know, to other South Asian women. So there's a real massive issue. So although we're Western in one particular way, where we get access to, say, content from America, the UK, Europe, inherently, if you go back to India and Pakistan, which I do a lot, and my family's still there, are very much entrenched in the fact that these are the way that things are done. And, you know, sex before marriage or sex outside marriage, and the vitriol that comes with that, and the, you know, the, what will people say about you, and the shame and the stigma that's attached to that. So my family in Pakistan find it very bizarre that I'm on TV. And actually, a lot of people in my community find it very bizarre that I'm on TV, purely because that inherent stigma is still there.
Mm. Has that changed regards to media and TV personalities in Pakistan, or is that still kind of a male dominated industry?
It's really bizarre because you still don't talk about women's health on social media, like on TV, right? So it's okay to have the woman as this dainty, helpless figure who is like waiting for the man. And once she's married, then she's hidden away from the world, and that's it. And, it, you know, getting old is just a massive. So all those sort of the hanger-on effects from the Western community, I feel like, are still something that we need to grapple with as South Asian people, and particularly for women as well, because that does play a role in how you then practice medicine as a GP, because especially when you're not understanding the cultural nuances. So I did a workshop as a GP for lots of Pakistani women, and I was like, I talked about all the contraceptives, and I was discussing how you can have contraception in Punjabi and Urdu, and learn all the words. And I thought, this is an amazing workshop. And these were women who could speak English quite well, but they just wanted it in their, you know, it was bilingual. We were changing from swapping from English to Punjabi and Urdu and stuff like this. And the women at the end of it, all really intelligent. One was a lawyer, one was a pharmacist, and, you know, and actually one was a doctor, a trainee at Wexham Park, with sort of women who were housewives, and one was a dancer. They came at the end and just went, thank you so much for the information, but I'm going to go home and get my husband to decide and make a decision with my husband. I know I've got to run this past my husband. And I just thought to myself, oh my goodness, this is still inherently inbuilt with us, because we cannot get past the fact that even our bodies don't belong to us. They belong to the men in our South Asian community or our partners. And that comes from, again, that sort of limitation that we have over the control of our bodies. And so I am a misnomer and a bit of an outlier. You know, some people think I'm like really crazy, and I always go back to my why, and I'm sure you do. Whenever you do something, you're like, why am I posting something on social media? Like, why? Because there is this horrible side to it. So it's such a double-edged sword. I suppose my why is that if I don't do it, who will, with the knowledge that I've accumulated? And I'm not big-headed. I'm humble enough to know that I don't know everything. But also, I think that I came here when I was 9, and I never saw me in a GP surgery. I never saw me on TV. I came to leafy Buckinghamshire, and I still, apart from, say, Nadia from Bake Off, don't see me. Yeah. And that Nadia who won Bake Off was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. And even then, she challenged. I remember I was doing GP training. I was a GP registrar at the time in a very kind of white Caucasian kind of practice, and I was the only Asian there. But it was amazing how throughout that series, they just grew to love Nadia because at the beginning she was Nadia with a headscarf and kind of, you could see the labels from my colleagues. And it wasn't their fault, it's just they weren't used to seeing someone who looked like her on a primetime TV show watched by millions, by the way. Probably the most popular TV show at the time on BBC. By the end of it, she was so loved and everyone wanted her to win. So I think she did, I don't think it's kind of, you know, I don't think it's hyperbole, but she kind of really changed a lot of narratives really for South Asian women, women who wear hijabs, Muslim women, because she just was Nadia. She wasn't Nadia who had a headscarf, who, you know, who could bake. She was actually just this wonderful person who's done so well now, and she's made the Queen's birthday cake and things like that. And she's, you know, she's through that show. And I think, like you said, representation matters. You know, I have a daughter who's turning 12, well, 12 going on 17, I should say. And it's, you know, dealing with that, but also the fact that, and I've said this to you offline, that, you know, seeing people like you, Miguel, and kind of seeing, like, even, you know, the Vice President of the United States being half Indian, you know, black, and just, that's huge for her, you know, to see that, and that be okay, that be normal, you know. And I think, you know, regardless of politics, you know, even seeing someone like Rishi Sunak, you know, as Prime Minister, you know, if you ask my dad, you know, 40 years ago when he was came here as a junior doctor, and you know, he was on the hospital cricket team, he was the only brown person on the hospital cricket team, and they went to a pub after a cricket match, and he was turned away because they didn't want him in the pub. And like, that was literally 40 years ago. So we've gone from that to where we are now. There has been tremendous progress, but there's still a lot of work to do, challenging kind of stereotypes. And I think you mentioned a good point about microaggressions. I mean, how do you deal with microaggressions? Before we get to kind of, we wrap up in the final question, how do you deal with microaggressions? Because that's slightly different, isn't it? Can you kind of explain a bit more? Because you mentioned racism, which is obviously horrific, but what about microaggressions, and how do you as a GP and as a professional deal with that in a work setting?
Microaggressions are a constant part of, I think, anyone who is different to the norm, and I am very different to the norm. And so it would always be like, oh, what is that thing on your head? Or are you bald underneath that? Is that why you wear a headscarf? And so, or the assumption that I am how I am just because of the way I look or the skin color, or the fact, you know, that I'll have an accent or I can't speak English. I think that's that micro assumption that you will have that. And I think that the thing that we forget about as people of color is that people are naturally drawn to someone who's palatable still, I think, to the white Caucasian population. So for example, if you think about Beyonce, she changed everything, you know, blonde hair to be palatable. You're constantly doing that. And I could curtail my inherent excited Punjabi way of doing things because I'm very Punjabi. So as you know, Punjabi people get very excited. We get very angry. I'm very aware that if I walk into a room, I'm going to be the angry brown woman. I'm not just going to be, she's angry about this without my color ever playing part of it. So that sort of mental load that we carry of how palatable are we going to be in this meeting that we're having at the CCG or on a CCB now, how much can I push the line as a woman of color and show my frustration? I suppose the other thing is that humor really helps when you come to microaggressions. I'm very smiley naturally, and I do make jokes. I take everything on the chin. I have flaws. I am not perfect. And the only way to do that is to completely reflect and recheck your behavior, but then actually not change your identity. I think if anyone's listening to this podcast, I would just say you are perfect the way you are, in every shape or form, whether you're from South Asian heritage and you're from an LGBTQ plus community, whether you're neurodivergent, whether you have a hearing impairment or a visual impairment, whether you come from a traveler community, because we forget there are people who are from traveler communities who are from South Asian heritages, whether you are a refugee in this country, you are literally perfect as you are. And we are circles being made to fit into square. communities constantly. And I just decided many years ago, and this really started when I was in medical school, and the first bit of microaggression I had was a white Caucasian consultant in A&E at Barts. I started my rotation and she said to me, "Your name is too difficult to pronounce. Can I call you Nicola?" And I went, I found it somewhere. And she did this in front of the whole peer group. You know, we were all same medical students. To be fair, they all had my black students who were there, the medical students, they had very sort of Christian names. And we had this conversation because you're saying James is such a Christian name. It's really easy to pronounce. But so people don't have it. But I have a name called Nagat. Nagat in Arabic is pronounced Nijat, and Nijat means to rescue. So on the Day of Judgment, you will want Nijat there. And in Punjabi or Urdu, it's actually Nighat. So my name is very anglicized already, Nagat. Yes. And so again, it's because you want to be palatable to a Western audience. So you anglicize your name, even though that's not your name. And now I carry that everywhere. So you've already taken on that palatability for a white audience. And she said to me, "I can't pronounce your name. Can I complete?" And I found it inside me to go, "No, my name is Nigat, and I will teach you how to say it." And everybody around me was just like, "Whoa, what is going on?" And I think there are times when you just have to stand your ground. So whether that's, where are you from? No, where are you really from? That question. Your name is really difficult to pronounce. Can I shorten it for you? And you're like, "No, like that's, you can't do that," or change it. Or can I give you a nickname? And you're like, "No, you." So there are red lines that I have, and those are my red lines. And I think there are other times when you just have to, unfortunately, leave the microaggression and move on because life's too short.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I've had it. Yeah, that's, thank you so much for sharing. I've had it both ways. You know, I've had a medical student, when I was a medical student, a colleague of mine saying, "Is James your real name?" And actually, I'm named after
really?
My grandfather.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. I'm named after my grandfather. You know, shock horror, there are Christians in the South, you know, in South Asia, in, you know, Sri Lanka and India. And so, but the fact that he asked me that, I was shocked by that. Thambiraj is really difficult for a lot of people to pronounce. So I've been, "Can I call you Dr. T? Can I call you Dr. James?" And so sometimes that can be quite difficult. My dad is a retired ENT surgeon, so was right from the beginning. "No, you can remember Thambi Raja, very easy. Thumb, your thumb, a B, like, and he would actually do the buzz, bzz, and then Raja," and he would actually kind of to all his patients and all his colleagues. And so, I'm thankful for kind of mentors like my dad, who's kind of, he's kind of like a trailblazer. But yeah, I mean, dealing with microaggression, like you said, life is too short. But also, you know, even though my name is James Thambi Raja, I still have problems with that in the sense of trying to anglicize it or shorten it. Someone said to me, "Oh, the snow must be new for you. How are you dealing with snow?" I'm like, "Oh, okay." In my head, I'm like, "I'm from Cot Fosters in North London. I've had snow before." I was like, in my head, I don't know what was going on. So just to wrap up, Nigat, so it's been such a lovely conversation, but what's kind of, if someone who's listened to this podcast and wants, you know, about South Asian heritage management, perhaps they're younger or they're a student, what do you want your legacy to be? It's a bit of a heavy question, but what do you want them to learn or take away from your experience as a GP and someone from your kind of background? What would your advice to them about your legacy and how would you inspire them?
Before I answer that, I just want to go back to that name thing because it really does sadden me. I do know there was a generation of South Asian doctors and consultants who changed their name entirely to a Western name, because when you put your name on an application, if they saw like Mark or, you know, Dave or David, or then you're more likely to go up in the ranking and your application wouldn't be put in the bin. And their real name was something like, you know, Pratib. It's so sad. And I actually do speak to them and I feel that we've moved on from there, I feel, at the RCGP. And we have such beautiful names in our culture, in our communities, which go back millennia, and our ancestors had them and they're generational. And so if the first thing I said, if people could learn Kardashian, they can definitely learn, they knew the pronunciation of Kardashian, they can definitely learn the pronunciation of Nagat. So I am Dr. Nagat first, that's great. In regards to legacy, I suppose that is a heavy question. I just want to be known that she was smiley. She tried her best. And okay, I had this thing right once that because I'm very spiritual and faith is really important. And as Muslim, we prepare for our death quite a lot. So we have a 6 foot sheet, white sheet that me and my husband have in our home. And I shared it with my 12-year-old because should we pass, we have what's known as a patka. Patka is what you wrap yourself up in, because we don't have coffins and stuff. You just wrap yourself up in a single white sheet and then that's it, you're gone. And we don't believe that you're gone, because you'll be reunited. And I said that regardless of however people remember me, I just want someone somewhere to say she came, she tried to change the dial a tiny bit in the minuscule way for women's health and for representation, and I'd be a very happy woman.
Oh, wow, that's really powerful. Can I just say, from a personal level, you crank up that dial right to the max, and you've done so much already.
You're biased. You are so biased.
No, I'm a bit biased, I must admit, but you, Hannah, and you've inspired us so much. Well, thank you, Nagat. It's been wonderful to hear your story. And to describe what South Asian heritage means to you, and that how that intersects with women's health and your lived experiences, and how it's shaped your practice.
And that brings us to the end of our podcast. I'd like to say a huge thank you to Dr. Nagat Arif for joining us, and thank you everyone for listening to Team GP Perspectives. Please join us in our next podcast, where I'll be speaking to Dr. Carter Singh about race, blending cultural traditions, and his lived experiences as a South Asian GP. If you'd like to learn more about South Asian Heritage Month or the topics we've discussed, check out the description box for links and resources. If you're enjoying these conversations, then please share them with a friend or tag us in your next social media post using @TeamGP or @RCGP. Thanks for listening, and take care.